you want to share with everyone the nickname that I gave you about LeBron?
I think, yeah, the LeBron stopper, because of the fact that no one defends LeBron like I do.
Oh, I mean, you go above and beyond. I mean, even his little, interior circle of friends that went to high school together and won all those AAU national titles and state titles, even though, like, Jrue Joyce, all those guys, even those guys do not defend LeBron James from criticism as adamantly and as consistently as you do. And this is your chance to explain, why do you give this guy such a pass on his personality, on his choke ability, on his just ridiculous hijinks before the games, the fact that he's not focused, not prepared to play in the playoffs, all these other things outside of the game matter more to him than the actual game itself, the fact that he's not really dedicated to winning, never really won anything besides, a couple state titles. How do you defend this? I mean, why are you
Besides
such a
getting to
LeBron
the
James?
NBA Finals with just a ridiculously weak supporting cast, it's terrific, the mentality that if you don't win the championship, you haven't won anything. That, like, if it's the same as if you don't make the playoffs if you lose in the NBA Finals. So that's one of the things I love about modern society.
Hold on. The first good team he played that year was in the NBA Finals. How'd that work out for them? I
What did
forget what
Detroit win
happened.
that year? 55 games? I mean, we're talking about a team that had been to the finals two of the previous three seasons there. We're not talking about, the Washington Generals.
Oh, well, yeah, okay. We're not talking about the freaking Chicago Bulls either. Who was the first good team they played that year? San Antonio Spurs, right?
Probably.
Okay, and what was the result?
They got swept.
Okay, there you go. And did LeBron James put up any fight?
I think he did. I don't know. I don't really remember. I kind of tried to pretend that the 2007 NBA Finals never happened, because that has got to be about the most boring finals series of all time.
Well, exactly. If LeBron James had stepped up, you would not be saying those words. Okay, that's a point in my column. Go ahead and continue with your defense.
Now, you have watched the Celtics play in the Eastern Conference Finals against Orlando, correct? Are we prepared to give maybe just the slightest bit of credit to Boston, that maybe this is a really good team that is, when they're locked in, as they have been during the playoffs, when they've gone so far 10-3, including, I believe, off the top of my head now, 5-1 on the road, or 5-2 on the road? Is it apparent yet that this is actually an awfully good team that just didn't look that way in February through April, because they were saving everything for one last playoff push?
No, I definitely think we should give a lot of credit to the Boston Celtics, but that's just a distraction from the real argument here is, okay, so let's pinpoint what my beefs are with LeBron James in that series specifically. Number one, he's lackadaisical and totally brushing off any sort of a fear or concern about, the early losses in that series.
Whoa, whoa,
Would you agree?
whoa, 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 When, like, Dirk Nowitzki gives credit to, the Nuggets last year and says that they defended him really well in game one, then all the talking heads say, "Oh, you can't give any credit to your opponents." But when you don't take it that seriously, then all of a sudden you're being lackadaisical. It's such a double standard, which is typical from you media types.
Well, no, I mean, that's a totally different issue because, Dirk's being honest, LeBron's being, conceited.
I'm saying they're both getting criticized for it, so you can't win. It's, if you don't win the game, you're not going to win the press conference, no matter what you say.
And I would disagree. I mean, let's just see a little bit of credit or respect due to anyone besides himself is what we're looking for from LeBron James, aren't we?
I don't think that's not the case. Look at his decision to change his jersey number next year out of respect for Michael Jordan.
Oh yeah, that's really why he did it. It's not just to put himself in the headlines for 6 months. Come on, KD. You really are the LeBron stopper. All right.
That was just a
So,
convenient argument. I will grant that one.
okay, thank you. Not that I need you to grant me arguments, because I'm rolling over you like LeBron James rolls over Mo Williams or something. But okay, so number one, he didn't handle the losses very well, correct? Number two, did he really have to say he's going to stop Rondo and then he doesn't stop Rondo?
Did he say that?
Oh yeah, he said he was going to take over. He was going to take over defensive responsibility on Rajon Rondo late in the series. Never happened. Rondo
I
cut
thought
him
Mike
up like
Brown said that.
well, Mike Brown let him do it. No. Mike Brown was – he basically forced Mike Brown's hand on that. That was a whole other sidebar. Oh, that's the other thing. That's a bigger point. Is he kind of sold his coach out, didn't he?
I don't know that he did that.
You don't think that he sold Mike Brown out? He quit. 2 games in a row he quit at the end of the games. They didn't foul. Everybody was following his negative body language. He had all these turnovers. He seemed totally disinterested in that one game when Mike Brown, you know, wasn't perhaps playing the lineups that LeBron was hoping that he would play. He just gave up and stood in the corner. Looked like Rudy Fernandez.
Look, I don't think there's a lot of way to defend the way that LeBron responded in the second half of Game 5 of that series, but it's one game out of his entire career, and if you want to blow that up into a huge thing, then that's fine, but let's be blowing up the Kobe Bryant Game 7 at Phoenix and things like that as well, okay?
Well, the point is that you can have those kinds of games. I'm not defending Kobe. I'm not a huge Kobe fan either way. You know, I respect his game immensely. I think he's one of the top 2 players in the league, but you know, I'm not a Kobe stand by any stretch of the imagination. But Kobe has at least been there before and knows what it takes to win. LeBron has no clue what it takes to win an NBA title. And then he goes out and quits on his coach. And he doesn't realize it's going to have repercussions in Game 6 and Game 7 and going forward in the future of his career. When Kobe quit on his team, he quit because he knew that even if he played his hardest and everything had gone exactly right, they weren't going to win because it wasn't their year. And he had been there before. He'd experienced the victory, and he knew just it wasn't going to work, correct? LeBron has no idea. LeBron's just quitting because he's pouting, because he's emotional about it.
Well, LeBron came back in Game 6 and played as well as he could have possibly played. He played the Boston defense. You know, he tried to do too much, I think. I don't think we'd question that, but that was because that was apparently the only way for Cleveland to score at that point. And, I mean, I think the series says much more about, you know, the one-dimensional nature of the players around LeBron James and about the Celtics defense than it really says about LeBron.
Yeah, and so I think this is the biggest final myth about LeBron is how he makes his teammates better. Did any one of his teammates look better than they actually are in that series? Did he make anyone better?
Players make their teammates better by taking difficult situations off of them. They can't go out there and make the shots better. I mean, you know, there's maybe some guys who emotionally with their leadership, but that's a very subjective enterprise, and that's not really my interest, as you know. But in terms of, you know, setting guys up with good looks, Mo Williams has, you know, no-showed at key moments in the last 2 series Cleveland has lost. And, you know, after the whole All-Star fiasco in 2009, I find it awfully hard to take that seriously, take him that seriously.
Okay. I agree with you on Mo Williams. I think he's a D-League point guard. Delonte West. Did he make Delonte West better? Did he make Varejao better? Did he make Shaq better? Did he make Z better? Did he
Shaq
make Antoine
individual
Anderson better?
I mean, Shaq did have a good individual series. He actually was the other guy who played well.
But it had nothing to do with LeBron. LeBron wasn't, like, feeding him, getting all these incredible alley-oop pick and rolls. I mean, it's just kind of they dumped it into Shaq, and Shaq did whatever he normally does. And he sloughed his way to, you know, 20 points on occasion.
No, but did Kobe make Kwame Brown and Swish Parker and those guys better? I mean, you know, he was able to carry that team to the point where it did make the playoffs and it contended with the Suns, surprisingly, in that series, you know. But ultimately, he needed better players around him, and he became suddenly, in everyone's eyes, a better teammate when he had better players around him. It's funny how that always seems to work. So,
well, it is funny how that works, and that's what I'm trying to get at with LeBron is, does he actually make his teammates better right now? Because everybody said that's been the number one thing about him. It's like, he's Michael Jordan's scoring abilities with Magic Johnson's playmaking abilities and leadership abilities, and he makes his teammates better. But does he actually do that, or do his teammates still kind of suck?
I think the notion of making your teammates better is kind of a misguided one in general. I mean, again, yes, to the extent that like there's a relationship between usage and efficiency, and we know that if you're playing with a guy who uses as many possessions as James does or Jordan did or Kobe does, that you're going to shoot better when you're on the floor with them, and generally speaking, because of the fact that you're getting easier shots and having to create your own shot less often. That's how team players make their teammates better. I mean, there's some synergistic effects like, you know, Steve Nash and Amari Stoudemire, but in general, players are what they are. I mean, to me, what the makes his teammates better thing exists for is to say, well, I don't like this guy, so how am I going to justify it even though he has really good stats? Oh, I know, he doesn't make his teammates better.
Awesome. All right, well, I'll agree with you on that. I like that explanation. Very, very well said, KP. So now my final line of attack on LeBron James, because I think I've so far I'm undefeated. I think that you've caved on every single point so far. My final line of attack on LeBron James, overrated basketball intelligence. This guy's considered to be, and by you've told me this before, he has an incredible basketball IQ in your words. Very smart player, knows what he's doing on the court, knows how to read situations, knows how to read defenses, et cetera, et cetera. I think, you know, you've kind of pointed to, you know, the great team defense from Boston. LeBron James definitely did not look like the smartest basketball player on the court by a long shot in that series. He looks like someone who was kind of lost, confused, like you said, forcing, frustrated, settling for jumpers when he shouldn't be settling for jumpers, which I think is the number one sign of a player who's not intelligent, doesn't know his own limits, doesn't know when to tell himself to stop shooting, wasn't able to get to the free throw line as much as he normally does. I think he's got a little bit overrated at this point in terms of basketball intelligence. Agree or disagree?
Well, I don't know what his rating is, but I mean...
Oh, I think it's off the charts. People say he's the smartest player. You've said he has incredible basketball IQ. You've told me that before when I've made these kinds of comments on G-Chat.
I'm sure I have. But Orlando is a team that is very well coached, executes very well. High collective basketball IQ, even if I think maybe, you know, individually you wouldn't necessarily put Dwight Howard in that category at the offensive end. And, you know, Vince Carter throughout his career has been up and down in that regard. But collectively, you'd say their basketball IQ is really high, and they've looked tremendously confused in this series. I think you've got to say that a lot of that is the Boston defense. Now, is he overrated? I don't know. Maybe, you know. I don't know.
Maybe. Okay, I'll settle for that, too. Oof. This went way better than I thought it would. Jeez Louise, this is great. You know, you're never going to get that vice president of his marketing company position if you don't stand up for him a little bit stronger.
Not even going to get to sit on the board of his company.
Okay, anyway, enough jokes aside. I wanted you to explain something for me and to the listeners. We need to correct the record or explore this issue of isolation offenses. And this is, you know, ties in with the Cleveland Cavaliers, but also the Atlanta Hawks, and obviously also for our listeners, Portland Trail Blazers. It's been this whole line of thinking. Go ahead.
I don't know if it's correct because of the fact that, you know, there is no right or wrong. It's a matter of opinion, but I would like to make my opinion known. That's the point of this podcast, I suppose.
Perfect.
Besides making inside jokes.
Exactly, and getting you locked up. Let's get out sort of the conventional wisdom at this point. The conventional wisdom at this point dictates that certain coaches over-rely on their star wing player in isolation, turning over too much of the play calling or offensive structure to those players individually, allowing them to go one-on-one, or in some cases one-on-two or one-on-three or one-on-four and one-on-five, and create the offense, especially I think in crunch time. And that's not a winning playoff strategy. It may work in the regular season when teams don't have chances to game plan for you, but when a team like Boston or just a really well-coached, hardworking defense, even, you know, like the Lakers have turned it on defense, for example, when they're able to get certain guys in isolation and that's your offense, they're able to defend that to the point where it's no longer a viable strategy in the playoffs. I guess – one, how do you respond to that? And two, do you think some of those teams that I mentioned, like the Hawks or the Cavs or the Blazers, are more guilty of over-relying than others? And, you know, what's the plan, I guess, if you're the Blazers going forward? How would you address this issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think the core of the issue, it comes down to isolation versus more of a motion-based offense and something where the ball is moving, players are moving. And, I think that the argument that gets brought up, especially by our good friend Dwight James, is more of the Rick Adelman style offense that has some Princeton inspiration perhaps behind it and is very different stylistically. But I think the one thing that's a misconception is that Nate McMillan is fundamentally at his heart an isolation coach. And I just don't think that's true. You know, that's not the way that the Sonics played when Nate McMillan was a player, when he was developing a lot of his philosophy of the game. He's talked a lot about his admiration for Jerry Sloan and the Utah Jazz and how much he'd like to play like them. They're not an isolation team. The Sonics, when he was the coach in Seattle here, were not a heavy isolation team. I mean, sure, they used it from time to time with Ray Allen, but, you know, when that team was really going well in the 2004-05 season in particular, it was primarily a pick-and-roll-based offense. And what I think you had there was guys who were better equipped to run that kind of offense than you have in Portland. I think that's where he's made this adjustment based on the talent that he has, and the Blazers just haven't found a consistent role guy. You know, that's not Greg Oden's strength when he's been healthy. Joel Prisbilla is not a terrific finisher at the rim. He's not somebody who's going to make a tough catch in pat traffic when he's coming off of a pick and roll. And then LaMarcus Aldridge, who in theory should be that guy, I think generally you can agree or disagree with me on this, I think tends to be more effective as a pick and pop player than when he's actually, you know, rolling to the basket off of that. So I think that Nate would like to run more pick and roll and have that be the staple of his offense. But just because of who he has and Brandon Roy's ability in one-on-one situations, that's what's kind of led him to more of an isolation offense and less of a pick and roll offense. Thoughts on that?
Okay. Well, I think that, you know, first on the Aldridge thing, I don't think he's very comfortable putting the ball on the ground going towards the basket. So, you know, if he's rolling and he gets the pass at 15 feet, I don't think he's the kind of player who's going to take one dribble and get to the rim. You know, sort of like an Amari Stoudemire, who I think maybe arguably would be the best roll guy in the league right now.
Yeah, I think without question.
And I think what Amari likes to do is, you know, and I've been watching a lot of the Suns, obviously, because they've been making this great run through the playoffs. But I think he really likes to get that one dribble explosion from around the free throw line where he is able to kind of, you know, size up the defense facing it on the move, using his quickness, his power, and, you know, just one and maybe, you know, occasionally two dribbles and just elevating. And that's just not, you know, Aldridge just doesn't work that way. He's not wired that way. And maybe he can change that, but, you know, it doesn't really seem to be, you know, his nature as a player. So I agree with you on that. They don't really have any role guys. And, you know, part of the problem, I think, though, is Brandon Roy and how he uses picks. I mean, he almost always uses picks no matter where he is on the court. He uses picks to look for his own shot, or he looks for picks to drive. And I think, you know, one thing that stuck with, you know, people, observers of the Blazers who maybe are really down on, you know, the isolation aspect of the offense recently is that, you know, Brandon hasn't been healthy for what, 4 or 5 months prior to the end of the season, fully healthy. And the isolation offense is only really going to work if the person who has the ball in his hands is able to get to the free throw line and is able to, you know, shoot the ball on balance, you know, and get his own shot from wherever he is. If Brandon Roy is not able to draw fouls, not able to explode to the basket, basically the whole offense just falls apart. It doesn't work because everybody can just play up in his grill. You know, if he can't get to the basket, it just, you know, he's not able to get the shots that he normally would. He can't get the high percentage looks. His shooting percentages are going to drop. His scoring consistency is going to drop. And the entire, you know, efficiency of the offense just doesn't work any longer. And I think if I have a problem with Nate's approach to it, the isolation, it's not necessarily the theory in principle. I kind of like the idea of putting the ball in Brandon's hands. In the past, it's shown to be incredibly efficient. But if he's not all there, Nate needs to step in and say, hey, Brandon's not totally healthy. We can't continue to go to this play after play after play after play. It's just simply not working. And I think in some cases, Nate's been overly stubborn in sticking so closely to it and not having necessarily a backup plan in place. Does that make sense? And would you consider that a fair criticism?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. You know, I compare it to Game 1 of the Eastern Conference Finals when we saw the Magic keep dumping the ball inside to Dwight Howard. even when it became clear he wasn't scoring one-on-one in Kendrick Perkins. Like, it's no criticism of Dwight Howard. You know, that's a very tough defensive matchup, even one-on-one. And, you know, sometimes you just don't have your, it's just not your night. But you can't keep going to that. At some point, you've got to try something else when it's not working. So, you know, I think it would be nice. And I think it's true that for the second unit in particular, it might be helpful to have more of a motion-based offense at times, because of the fact that what you see with the Jazz is they don't rely on players to create their offense. They rely on the offense itself, you know, to create their offense. And I think that's what makes some of their second unit players so effective there. You know, remember back in the 90s when they had guys like Shannon Anderson and Howard Eisley who were great with the Jazz, and then they went somewhere else and were a free agent flop because of the fact that it turned out it was really the offense and, yes, making them better, or at least look better. I would say that the other thing is, about this is I'm not as convinced as everyone else that the isolation offense can't work in the playoffs. You know, the stat I pointed out on Twitter yesterday that pulled from Synergy is that the Lakers are using a fairly high percentage of their possessions, in fact, more than the Blazers this year, although Roy's injury is probably something to do with that and the fact that he was out as long as he was. But they're using a higher percentage of their offense on isolations, and it doesn't seem to have stopped them in the playoffs. In fact, their offense is playing much better in the playoffs, despite the fact that they're not, you know, just we can talk all about the triangle into a blue and a teeth. They don't really run it anymore. They have a very low rate of assisted baskets right now. They're relying a lot on players to create offense individually, and it's working just fine.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the big keys there is Kobe Bryant, right? When he's in isolation, he's very talented at drawing fouls, and he's, you know, got the full range of jump shots that, you know, in his arsenal. So he's the double threat, and that's kind of what Brandon Roy would like to be. But if Brandon's not healthy, he just can't. I mean, he never can really approximate Kobe at this point in his career. But if he's injured, he certainly is a totally different player. Looking at an injured Brandon Roy compared to a healthy Kobe Bryant, and for all intents and purposes, he's probably not totally healthy right now, but he's pretty dang close to healthy. He's playing like he's healthy, putting up 40 points. You know, it's just apples and oranges, right? I mean, you look points per possession, it's not even going to be close.
Yeah, but in the argument is that the isolation is never going to work no matter what from some of these critics, and I just don't buy that. I mean, personally, I'm a pick-and-roll guy myself. If I am on the record as saying that if I ever coached an NBA team, we'd run like five different pick-and-rolls every play, and we'd probably, you know, have no motion, no real motion or offense, and never run isolations. But I'm crazy like that. So, you know, I'm coming at it with a different bias than some of these people who are, you know, interested in more of a motion offense.
You know, I'm a turnover guy myself. I only want to see my team to make turnovers.
Well, you and Dean Demopoulos would not get along well then.
Polar opposites, if you will. So going back to the issue of the isolation offense. So I think one other issue, and I think I want you to explain this or give me your reaction to it. One other thing that people maybe are getting confused with the Blazers isolation offense is the issue of pace. Do you think that it looks worse, or it seems like it's a bigger deal, the isolation part of it, because the team plays so slow? Do you think that that kind of exacerbates everyone's feelings towards it? And so when a team like Atlanta, they, you know, they're not the slowest team in the world during the regular season. They can get up and down a little bit. Jamal Crawford can score some baskets. You know, they got some guys who can shoot. Josh Smith's nice in transition. But when the game slows down a little bit in the playoffs, maybe their isolation looks worse and is less effective. Do you think there's an element of pace that's kind of overshadowing this discussion that maybe doesn't get brought up enough? Because it seems to me like Nate McMillan, maybe he's not committed necessarily to the isolation offense, like you've pointed out and explained pretty well, but he does seem to be pretty dang committed to a slow pace.
Yes and no. I mean, I think you can run a slow pace and run one bunch of pick and rolls and do something similar. You know, I think that's more an element of how quickly you run the offense, how much you run multiple actions within the same play. You know, if the first thing you run doesn't work. And I think as far as the postseason and that argument, you know, I think it really comes more from when you run up against an elite defense like the Blazers did last year with Houston, like this year Atlanta did with Orlando and Cleveland did with Boston? Are you going to be able to execute the isolation in situations like that? And, I think it's a legitimate question. I would say right now that it's an open question how well it works in those scenarios. Other people have looked at those three playoff series, which I don't think is enough, and you can throw out the Blazers this year against the Suns because of the fact that, that was not the real Blazers, what with Roy being a shadow of himself to the extent that he was even on the floor. So I don't think you can take anything from that. So they've looked at those three series and concluded based on them, well, the isolation struggles against elite defenses. To me, that's drawing reading too much into the data. The plural of anecdote is not data. And, I'd like to try and study the issue a little bit more. And, maybe then I would be comfortable saying that it's an issue in the postseason. Because, the one thing you can't say is that the isolation offense doesn't work in the regular season because, Nate McMillan has coached, the number three offense in the league, number two or three in 2004-05 in Seattle, and then the number two offense in the league last year in Portland. So there's no argument that it doesn't work in the regular season.
So at this point, it doesn't sound to me like you're ready to make any sort of recommendation to change the Blazers offense when it comes to pace or it comes to the situational breakdowns. I mean, what would you have any prescription going into next season if you kind of had a best case scenario for how you would tweak things? I mean, I would say less reliance on Brandon Roy. That's tough because they don't have a lot of other guys who are really ready to step up and take on that offensive responsibility. But I think that in the long run, Brandon is just not a consistent enough player. He's not playing 70 plus games every season, which he needs to be if they're going to turn over so much of this offense to him. And that's one thing that Mike Brown can get credit for. It's like he knows LeBron's going to be able to play every single game, right? So he can go ahead and game plan and tailor everything around LeBron. LeBron's just, a physical specimen. Brandon Roy is not like that. And so Nate McMillan at some point has to remind himself, hey, this can't be Brandon Roy and everybody else because Brandon might not play for stretches of every season from here going forward, I mean, he's just not a guaranteed 70 game a year kind of guy. And I think that would be where my adjustment would come from. I would look to, spread out some of that responsibility, whether that's more LaMarcus, whether that's Odin, if you can get him in there, whether that's just more pick and rolls like you're talking about, getting guys like Bayless and Andre Miller involved more. He's got to spread out some of that responsibility in my eyes. Is there any? Would you agree with that or disagree, or how would you approach next season's tweaks?
To me, it all starts with personnel. So first off, you have to know what your personnel are going to be. Are you going to have Greg Oden for 70 games next year? Because if so, you're throwing the ball in the post a lot more, and that's changing your offense, and you're playing inside out in a very different way from this season. Whereas, if Oden, for whatever reason isn't healthy or isn't effective in the post, then, you're running an offense that's a lot more similar to this year. So it's kind of hard for me to say without looking into a crystal ball.
Yeah, and I think that's probably, what has driven a lot of the over-reliance on Brandon. I think Nate's probably faced those same questions and thought, the easiest solution is just to let Brandon handle this, or the most reliable solution is just let Brandon go and roll with it because, he's the most reliable. He's the most consistent, I think. Finally this year, I think that kind of, that kind of ran out on him because Brandon wasn't in as many games and he wasn't able to be that same Brandon Roy that he has been in the past. And he definitely wasn't. I mean, you look at his efficiency numbers, points per possession just dropped when he's injured. It's night and day clear. All right. Anything else on isolation that we haven't covered? Would you bring Mike Brown back if you were able to keep LeBron if you're Cleveland?
If keeping Mike Brown meant keeping LeBron?
Yeah. No, let's say you have LeBron and he agrees to stay, would you consider bringing Mike Brown back?
Probably not. I think it's just time for a new voice. And, I think my issues with his offenses were uncreative, but ultimately they were some of the best in the league during the regular season at the very least. So, I think that I think that Mike Brown, what really hurt him this year in the playoffs was he didn't just stick to his plan. I felt there was an element of like panic and what are we trying to do here? Are we playing Ilgauskas? Are we playing Hickson? And there wasn't, a resolution to, you got to make adjustments in the playoffs, but also you have to have a solid base to start from. And I don't think they ever had that is where I think that Cleveland was let down by Mike Brown in this series.
I agree with you. All right, hey, now I feel bad about running over you earlier in this podcast about LeBron James, so I want to give you the bully pulpit to tell me and other LeBron, quote-unquote, haters, people who are down on LeBron's personality, and you know, I do think that LeBron's the best player in the NBA, but what is one thing that people who rag on LeBron are missing? You know, what are we missing from the LeBron James experience by focusing on all these negatives, the sideshows, all the other ridiculous stuff that LeBron does, and the fact that, you know, maybe he's never quote-unquote won anything, or, you know, what are we missing? What is being overlooked by people in that situation? So you can get your full LeBron James defense on here.
You mean besides the fact that he's really, really good at basketball and that he's, like, doing things statistically that basically have rarely been done before? I mean, you know, he's, the last two seasons, I think, are two of the top six or seven or eight warp seasons of the last 30 years. So, you know, that's pretty good in my book. I would just put it this way. The quote that begins Moneyball, I can't remember the term for that. That which the gods wish to destroy first they call promising. And I feel like there's an element of that in LeBron. We love to build people up and then tear them down, and that's what LeBron is seeing right now.
But didn't LeBron build himself up, and isn't that part of the extra joy with LeBron, is that he's so complicit in that hype?
Well, I suppose when you give yourself a nickname, you know, or at least allow yourself to be given the nickname King James, and the marketing campaigns around your shoes are all based basically in biblical prophecy, then yeah, I suppose there's an element of that. But yeah, it's not like anybody needed any help building LeBron James up. I mean, I don't think he was putting himself on Sports Illustrated when he was in high school. He wasn't televising his own high school games. You know, this is bigger than him.
Okay, that's a good point. All right, any final thoughts, KP? Is there anything we should be looking for from basketball perspectives? Anything that you want people to know about between now and the finals, now and draft night, like maybe who you're going to pick or who we should keep an eye on, who you're going to trade with?
Well, if you're going to give me an open floor, then I'm going to make my pitch that if you're feeling the withdrawal from professional basketball and basketball in general, then no better time than the present to make that fun drive up I-5 that I'm so familiar with to come see the Seattle Storm at the WNBA, which tipped off on Sunday.
Oh, how was opening night?
It was terrific. A 14-point win in the fourth quarter, but came from down one at the end of the third quarter and blew out the arch-rival L.A. Sparks in the final period. So a great start to the year, you know, and a quality team.
Now, I understand you guys have New Jersey sponsors?
Bing, yes.
Are you starting to feel like maybe Paul Allen sponsoring your mind?
Paul Allen sponsoring our lives, I think.
Our existences. All right, shout out to Mr. Allen. Shout out to Mr. Allen.
Shout out to Mr. Allen. I became more curious. Fuck being up north, delirious, more serious. So killer did mixtapes. CEOs heard, now here come Big Cake. But one cat said, Cam, you better recoup. For you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot. The best rap deal of all time, next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, I own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clap game. For that fame, grow entertainment. Sports, drugs, entertainment. To the arraignment killer.